My presentation on intelligence issues and the state of the world. On September 18, 1980, the world was unsettled. The president of Iraq, Saddam Hussein, had announced the previous day that the treaty defining the border between his country and Iran was no longer in effect. Troops from the two nations were already fighting skirmishes in southern Khuzestan. Iran's foreign ministry had condemned the hostile invasion by the Iraqi regime, and a war over the disputed territory seemed imminent. In Tehran, 52 American hostages were still being held captive, almost a year after being seized at the U.S. embassy there. A failed rescue attempt by the U.S. military during the spring of 1980 had prompted Iran's Revolutionary Guards to remove the hostages from the embassy and scatter them at locations throughout the city. Televised images of Iranian crowds burning American flags and shouting "Death to the Great Satan" had become a nightly routine, and the American government seemed powerless to do anything about it. Meanwhile, relations between the United States and the Soviet Union had reached their lowest point since the Cuban Missile Crisis in 1962. The Soviets had invaded Afghanistan 9 months earlier, deploying more than 100,000 troops in a campaign that many feared was just the first stage of a wider assault on the oil-producing nations of the Middle East. The United States had responded to the invasion by imposing a grain embargo on the Soviet Union and boycotting the recent Summer Olympics in Moscow. Neither of those punishments, however, seemed likely to force a Soviet withdrawal from Kabul. The influence of the United States seemed everywhere in decline. On September 17th, the International Institute for Strategic Studies, a prominent British think tank, issued a report suggesting that the Soviet Union's new and more accurate ICBMs had made America's ICBMs vulnerable to attack. The United States was falling behind not only in nuclear weaponry, the report claimed, but also in planes, tanks, and ground forces. Amid this discouraging international news, the mood of the American people seemed equally downbeat. The economy of the United States was in recession, with high inflation and an unemployment rate of about 8%. Gasoline shortages raised the prospect of rationing and federal limits on automobile use. Watergate, the Vietnam War, and the energy crisis had shaken faith in the ability of government to accomplish anything. The President of the United States, Jimmy Carter, had offered his own harsh critique of the national state of mind. During a speech broadcast by the three major television networks in prime time, the President warned that the United States faced an invisible threat, a crisis in confidence. Old-fashioned American optimism had been replaced by a despairing, self-absorbed worship of consumption. "Piling up material goods," Carter said, "cannot fill the emptiness of lives which have no purpose or meaning." The speech ended on a more practical note, outlining half a dozen steps to support renewable energy and eliminate the dependence on foreign oil. The underlying message, however, was that the nation's most important problems could never be solved by Congress or the President, and Carter urged viewers to assume responsibility for their own fate. "All the legislation in the world," he said, "can't fix what's wrong with America." Many Democrats and Republicans disagreed. They thought that Jimmy Carter was the problem, not some vague existential crisis of the American soul. It was a presidential election year, and Carter had gained the Democratic nomination after a bitter primary fight with Senator Edward M. Kennedy. Despite the victory, Carter's approval ratings plummeted. The Iranian hostage crisis brought more bad news every day, and an official report on the failed rescue attempt, describing how 8 American servicemen died and half a dozen U.S. helicopters full of classified documents were abandoned in the desert, raised doubts about the readiness of the military. Although Carter was a devout Christian, a newly created evangelical group, the Moral Majority, was attacking his support for legalized abortion and a constitutional amendment to guarantee equal rights for women. A midsummer opinion poll found that 77% of the American people disapproved of President Carter's performance in the White House, a higher disapproval rate than that of President Richard Nixon at the height of Watergate. The Republican candidate for president, Ronald Reagan, had a sunnier disposition. "I refuse to accept Carter's defeatist and pessimistic view of America," Reagan said. "The country could not afford 4 more years of weakness, indecision, mediocrity, and incompetence." Reagan called for large tax cuts, smaller government, deregulation, increased defense spending to confront the Soviet threat, and a renewed faith in the American dream. A popular third-party candidate, Congressman John B. Anderson, described himself as a centrist, labeling Reagan a right-wing extremist and Carter a bumbler. Anderson agreed that things had gone fundamentally wrong in the United States. "People feel that the country is coming apart at the seams," he said. The nation's underlying anxiety fueled sales of a best-selling nonfiction book in late September, Crisis Investing: Opportunities and Profits in the Coming Great Depression. A number of best-selling novels also addressed the widespread fears about America's future. The Devil's Alternative by Frederick Forsyth described a Soviet plot to invade Western Europe. The Fifth Horseman by Larry Collins and Dominique LaPierre described a Libyan plot to blackmail the United States with a hydrogen bomb hidden in New York City. The Spike by Arnaud de Borchgrave and Robert Moss told the story of a left-wing American journalist who uncovers Soviet plans for world domination but cannot persuade his liberal editor to publish them. Perhaps the most influential bestseller of the year was The Third World War, August 1985, a novel written by a retired British officer, General Sir John Hackett. It offered a compelling, realistic account of a full-scale war between NATO and the Soviet bloc. After a long series of European tank battles, the British cities of Birmingham and Wolverhampton are incinerated by a Soviet nuclear strike. The Russian city of Minsk is hit by nuclear weapons in retaliation, and the shock of its destruction causes the swift collapse of the Soviet Union. The moral of the story was clear. The United States and its allies needed to increase their military spending. In the last few years before the outbreak of war, the West began to wake up to the danger it faced, Hackett wrote, and in the time available did just enough in repair of its neglected defenses to enable it, by a small margin,